Amalgam Month returns. It's time for another four episodes where we dive deep into the history of DC versus Marvel. The byword starts now. Ladies and gentle nerds, welcome to a new episode of the Nerd Byword Podcast. I'm Dave, I'm here with my buddy Chris, and we are excited to once again dive into the history of DC versus Marvel, looking at new crossover miniseries and one-shots from the 90s collaboration between the big two comic book publishers. But first, as always, it's time for... Chris, you're speaking my language this week.
Well, listen, it's feels like a role reversal a bit, but in an amalgam episode, maybe it's proper. But we've gotten some Superman news lately. We've had a little bit of getting stuck in the mud here. Our wheels are getting stuck in the mud when it comes to our episode. So it's been a couple of weeks since this was revealed, but I just wanted an opportunity to talk about it. In celebration of Superman Day, we got a reveal of the S logo for the upcoming Superman movie and an amended name in a social media post. James Gunn said that the name of the film is just Superman now. We've also got some teases with Rachel Brosnahan, with David Corn-Sweat and Nicholas Holt on social media. We've got Wendell Pierce is confirmed as the casting for Perry White. So I just wanted an opportunity to give you some space as the resident superfan to talk about it.
Yeah, I think all of that is just extremely exciting. I think dropping the legacy subtitle is a really smart move. It makes the movie much more of a statement. It makes it very clear that this is not a sequel or a continuation of something else. If you think about it, we've never had actually a movie just titled Superman. Even the 1978 Chris Reeve movie was marketed as Superman the movie, right? So this is technically the first time we'll just have a movie called Superman. I think that was a very smart decision. I like the S, I have to say. It's a little removed from what most people would consider sort of the traditional S symbol for Superman. It's very reminiscent of the Kingdom Come S. I think that was designed by Alex Ross. I like it. It's a little more stylized. It's a little more difficult, I think, to recognize the S, kind of the way it blends in with the... with the surrounding shape a little bit, but I think the way it was presented in that little picture that we saw online, it actually looks quite good. I really like the texture of it too. It has almost a homemade look to it, you know, the way the material is. I kind of like that. It gives me hope that we'll get, you know, the fact that his mother made the costume for him in the movie, which I would really appreciate. That's always an interesting element, in my opinion. I'm just really excited about this movie, period. I have high hopes. I really hope that I don't get let down again, because there's so many things that I've been hyped about Superman related over the years, and most of them have not quite risen to the heights that I was hoping. You know, Superman Returns was middling at best, despite a decent cast, mostly. Man of Steel had decent casting, but the script really kind of let all that down, in my opinion. And so I'm kind of desperate just for a really good Superman movie. I feel like it's been... you know, for a really just good, strong Superman showing. It's been since, you know, the early 1980s that we've had just a really solid Superman movie. So I'm waiting for this. I have high hopes.
Yeah, I do as well. And, you know, another thing that happened that could have possibly easily been our news story. There's a certain director that we have been critical of. Zack Snyder showed up on Joe Rogan. That's a tag team right there, let me tell you. And
Jesus.
And kind of said some stuff that was really just, yep. And so that has kind of brought some of that fandom out of the woodworks, and they're now waylaying this new Superman movie. But I'm telling you what, I think DC film universe, I think it all hinges on this, to be completely honest. I know that there are other projects down the line that folks are excited for, and rightfully so, and I am as well, but I think this is really going to be the linchpin for the future of DC superhero films.
If this works, it'll work. If this doesn't work, none of it will work. That's exactly right. And, you know, I'll say what I've said many times about, you know, the fans of a certain director. If you like his work, more power to you. That doesn't mean you have to be sour towards everybody else's work, you know. And at some point, you have to acknowledge that that's he's not necessarily the taste of most fans of superhero comics. And some of the statements he's made, even since his involvement with Warner and DC has kind of waned, have been, you know, as you kind of said, not exactly on track with what most comic book fans would feel. And so, yeah, thanks, but no thanks is where I am with that situation.
Yeah. Dave, one of the benefits of us kind of being stalled with recording this episode is we've got some added context to your news story now.
Yeah. I mean, there's been big moving and shaking, and I think the world of video game emulation is shaking a little bit in its space boots at this point. So what we ended up having is a situation where Nintendo went after the developers of a Switch emulator called Yuzu, and filed a pretty substantial lawsuit against them in federal court, and you know, kind of accused them of creating software that you know, goes around their copyright protection, and you know, that they are responsible for major problems with sales of Tears of the Kingdom because there was a leak of the game. And so, you know, nobody would really, you know, have been able to use the leak if it wasn't for the software. So they were going after this particular emulator really, really hard. And it did not end well for Yuzu. Yuzu folded immediately. In only a couple of days of this story breaking, the developer of Yuzu, Tropic Haze, agreed to pay $2.4 million to Nintendo as a settlement. But in what is probably the more significant part of this for the larger world of emulation, they issued a statement that they agree that Yuzu is primarily designed to circumvent and play Nintendo Switch games. So the thing here is that Yuzu was developed, but it cannot work without product keys from an actual Nintendo Switch. So the actual process of making this emulator work rests very much with the individual fans. They have to, you know, make a copy of those product keys from their actual Switch. And so that has been sort of a methodology of many emulator developers, sort of a bring your own BIOS to the party kind of development, where as is, it doesn't work unless you yourself bring the copyrighted material with it, because you own a copy of the system and can copy those files over yourself. Yuzu saying now that their, you know, emulator was primarily designed to circumvent copy protection, even though it didn't do that out of the box, kind of sends a message to the larger world of emulator developers that this excuse will not work necessarily. This was a big fear even of letting this go to court. A lot of fans of emulation were really concerned that if this actually goes to court, that a court could find that emulators are not in fact legal, which is, you know, sort of the litmus test has always been of emulators, you know, developing, as long as you are not using any proprietary code or information, developing an emulator is in itself not an illegal activity. Pirating games and then playing pirated copies of those games on the emulator would be the illegal activity. But this, you know, is just a statement by one emulation developer, but you can kind of tell what Nintendo's going for here. They wanted them to go on record to say, yes, we were, you know, breaking copy protection, because this lays a foundation for, I think, future challenges, maybe of other emulators. Or, you know, and emulation is an interesting world. Obviously, piracy is, not legal. But when you're looking at stuff like really old video games, video game preservation, and the fact that Nintendo has always had a a fairly shoddy track record of making most of its library available in future iterations. I think there's a room for emulation as a way of preserving video games. And in fact, Nintendo itself has used emulators before for a lot of the stuff that they do with backwards compatibility, you know. So I think there's a space for emulation and emulators, even though, you know, piracy equals bad. And I'm a little concerned that the world of emulation could take a significant hit from these kinds of moves by Nintendo. Nintendo is not the most fan project friendly company anyways. You know, if you can contrast them to something like Sega, they've always been very open about fan projects and fan games, even bringing like some developers of fan games into the fold to help develop games that are official. And Nintendo has always kind of just come with a big stick and just beat everybody who gets anywhere near their intellectual property, whether that is, you know, streamers or people posting stuff on YouTube, you know, anything like that. They usually come out pretty hard against. And fan games have been struck down many times. I'm looking at like ASM2R and another Metroid remake that came out a few years ago, Metroid 2. That's, you know, fan beloved. And then they kind of immediately went after that. So this is par the course for Nintendo. They have a very love-hate relationship with their fandom, in that they want their fans to be consumers first and not creators in any way, shape, or form, like play with our toys, but don't, you know, make something else with our toys. And that's a pretty fraught relationship, I think, between Nintendo fans and Nintendo itself. I think there's room to say that Yuzu overstepped their bounds in several respects. Anyways, the developers of this had a Patreon, were raising money, you know, for development. And I think as soon as that there's a perception that you're maybe making money off of Nintendo's intellectual property, they will definitely come for you a lot harder than in some of the other cases. In most cases, they send a cease and desist and then, you know, they move on with life. But in this case, they made a statement. And what the impact of that's going to be long-term on the world of emulation and the legality of emulation is difficult to predict at this point. Now, Yuzu code is out there in the wild. It was an open source project, so I'm sure somebody is at some point going to pick up this code and try to further develop it and put it back out there into the wild. But yeah, I think the bigger hit is probably the other emulator that was involved in this, which is not getting nearly as much press, which is Citra. Citra was a Nintendo DS, 3DS emulator, and 3DS. And so considering that the 3DS has already reached its end of life, unless you're willing to brave a very, very fraught and overpriced secondhand market, which doesn't really benefit Nintendo anyways, you know, I mean, if you're buying a game used, then, you know, it's going to be increasingly difficult to try to revisit some of those 3DS games because Nintendo's not exactly making them available, like, for example, on Switch, right? So it's an interesting situation and definitely one to watch, I think.
Yeah, so this is a completely different foreign concept to me. I've never really emulated anything, but I know the iron grip that Nintendo has on their IP. I mean, even with something like Nintendo Switch Online, where they make stuff backwards compatible, that is exclusively games that they hold all the rights for. And, you know, you said something about Sega. Like, Sega is allowed to come play at Nintendo's party. They have the Mario and Sonic games, but it's not the other way around ever. It's like you can, like, I've been playing a little bit of the Mario plus Rabbids. Like, Ubisoft, you can come over here. And we control all of that stuff there, but it does not go the other way around. And so that's a really interesting thing to see, is something big like Nintendo, and they've got shooters, man.
Yeah, and I mean, this has always been Nintendo. You know, maybe it's a cultural thing, I'm not sure, but this has always been Nintendo. In going back to the NES, we're talking about the company that went after any company that tried to put out, you know, Nintendo NES games without their express approval and quality control, right? I mean, I'm looking at Tengen, for example, which had even their own version of Tetris out before Nintendo's version of Tetris came out. And you know, Tengen got the fold pretty hard too, you know? So they've been doing this for a long time and really have set the tone and the mood for that kind of thing. So what this is going to do in the future, who knows? Anyways, there you have it. That's it for our nerd news segment. Stick around as we dive into the world of DC and Marvel crossovers with All Access. So stick around. Ladies and gentlemen, nerds, welcome back. It's time, as always, for our... And in this week's Big Talk, we are revisiting our Amalgam Month. Now, for those of you that missed those episodes, you definitely need to go back and check those out. We've had a lot of fun with that. So in the mid-90s, we got a mini-series called DC vs. Marvel, which led into a series of one-shots featuring amalgamated mixed characters of various DC and Marvel characters. It still stands as one of the greatest and most substantial collaborations between both publishers. What probably has gone underappreciated over the years, I think, a little bit, is that beyond the original DC versus Marvel and Amalgam one-shot events, there were actually some sequels, including a couple of miniseries for an original character that was introduced and a second season of Amalgam one-shots. And so that is what we are diving into for this Amalgam Month. We will start our look at this collaboration between DC and Marvel with All Access numbers 1 through 4, a 4-issue limited miniseries that ran from 1996 until 1997. It starred the character Axel Asher, known as Access, somebody who can jump between the DC and Marvel universes. So, Chris... let's go ahead and talk about All Access. What is one thing you really liked about this miniseries?
Well, I think the first issue is really solid, and the team up with Superman and Spider-Man was great. I was glad to see Peter Parker back in the role of Spider-Man here, and seeing our two favorite superheroes kind of interact was really, really cool. I think you had mentioned this to me before, but Superman seemed kind of nerfed. So that was I'm not very familiar with 90s Superman, so that was a bit of an adjustment. But other than that, seeing them interact with each other, they meshed really well. Both of the characters were really well written by Ron Mars, and it was a fun little team up, and there was even a fun little line about newspaper journalists, and it was a good fun first issue. So that was probably my favorite thing about this whole endeavor.
Yeah, I too really liked the interaction between Superman and Spider-Man in particular. I think there's a lot of fun to be had there. Those two characters get on really well with each other. They mesh really well for some reason, and you really just want more interaction between the two, really.
All right, Dave, so what is your first like on DC Marvel All Access?
Yeah, it's really weird, man. I didn't actually know either of the artists involved in here, Jackson Butch Geiss and Joseph Rubinstein. I don't know either one of these artists, or I'm familiar really with their work, but I really, really enjoyed the art here. I thought it really sang and worked incredibly well. So yeah, and I think the art actually really connects well with like the DC versus Marvel miniseries. I think there's a really good sense of continuity in the visuals. So I'm not quite sure what else these two artists have worked on, but I really liked what I saw here, and I really need to dig further into that. I was shocked how completely unfamiliar names to me, especially as a reader from the 90s, were so solid on this miniseries. I really enjoyed the art here, Chris.
Yeah, the only time that I've seen Butch Geiss on art is actually a book that I have right here, is Black Panther and the Crew, one of my very earliest nerd commendations. But that came out here in the 2010s, like I want to say like 2016, 2017. So that was a good deal later after this. It's funny because 90s comics can be such a polarizing thing. And I think the art was pretty solid for the era. I think, but the only exception I'll take to that is I wasn't a real fan of how the Asian characters were drawn. There wasn't really any kind of distinct, they look pretty white. I mean, so they didn't look distinctly Asian. Axel's girlfriend and Jubilee both. So other than that, yeah, I thought it was a real fun art-wise, especially in the latter issues.
I think that's totally fair, absolutely. And I think that's a problem that has continued to this very day with certain artists and certain books, right?
Absolutely.
So that is a continuing issue, for sure. All right, Chris, so what was your second like of All Access?
Well, this could probably be, like, my greatest like of all of this, of all the DC Marvel amalgam, all of it, is Strange Fate. Doctor Strange Fate remains the best product of all of this, in my opinion. I think it's such... I know it's like a really easy combination with Doctor Strange and Doctor Fate, but that doesn't stop it from just being so cool. And especially when we get, like I said, to the latter issues in the series, we get some really ambitious and explorative art, and kind of that dreamscape astral plane type stuff is just, it's really, really fun. And I had even forgotten about the Charles Xavier of it all. And so that's just like, that's still probably my favorite thing about all of these comics.
And it's funny you say that, because I think that this is one of the few characters in this whole amalgam thing that ended up being more than the sum of its parts, if that makes sense. Like, I'm good about, like, Doctor Strange. I enjoyed Doctor Fate, particularly in combination with, like, you know, JSA stories over at DC. But there is something really, like, distant and mysterious and much more, I guess, almost dark about this character that makes him really fascinating, Doctor Strange Fate. And I'll talk a little bit more about, like, you know, how the whole antagonist thing of the story shook out here in a little bit. But I really think that Strange Fate in some ways is more than the sum of its parts in a lot of ways. It's just a really interesting character that actually manages to go beyond the individual characters from DC and Marvel in some ways, I think.
Dave, what was your second like of All Access?
So my second like is just the whole notion of these crossovers, which is something I don't think we really got enough in DC versus Marvel, right? DC versus Marvel was very fast, was serving a lot of characters, you know, and it was also very fight-oriented, which, you know, we've talked about before, is probably our least favorite element of superhero comics. You know, superhero versus superhero is not really where the fun's at in these kinds of stories. And so we got these really fast, like 2 to 3 page fights between superheroes, but no real, like, friendly interactions. How do these characters mesh? How would they work together to solve a problem? And I think that's really, in a lot of ways, the strength of All Access. You know, Axel Asher is probably not the most interesting character in the book by far. He's more of a gateway for all this to happen, right, in a story reason. But the character interactions that were fascinating were stuff like, you know, Superman and Spider-Man. I really liked the Robin Jubilee thing, especially as a reader of Robin back then. Like, I've read that entire run of Robin from that time period. It was always weird that they went for, like, this romance subplot with Jubilee and Robin when Robin was in a pretty serious relationship at the time in his own book, right? And here they address that a little bit and play around with that relationship a little more, right? And so those sorts of things... Batman and how he figures into interacting with Doctor Strange, for example. Those sorts of things were the most interesting element, which is, I think, why I found it disappointing to a certain extent that the end of it ultimately went back around to, you know, superhero versus superhero, because the three issues before that, you know, All Heck Breaks Loose, were by far the most interesting to me. These superheroes meeting and working together is really what I'm here for. And, you know, it took till the sequel to DC versus Marvel for us to get that in a significant amount. And this is what I was here for. Like, I like those a lot.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that'll probably be chief among our dislikes, not to get the cart before the horse, but it was funny because I went through like a shift in reaction to some of this stuff, particularly you mentioned the Jubilee and Robin stuff. Like, when I started that issue and, like, the whole idea behind that crossover is she's just this lovesick teenager and is completely messing with the sanctity of the time stream and the multiverse just because she wants to see Robin again. And
such a teenage move.
Yeah, I was like, this is just ridiculous. This is a terrible premise. But then at the end of the day, I was just like, you know what? As someone who teaches teenagers, this is perfectly in character. And yeah. So, yeah. And I really enjoyed that after I kind of came to my senses.
Yeah, I always got to keep in mind how teenagers make poor decisions all the time. Why not with the time stream too, right?
Yeah.
All right, Chris, what is your third and final like of All Access?
Well, similar to what I just said, this started as a dislike, but then it became a like when I just like embraced the campiness of it. There's like a fun, dorky 90s sitcom vibe. Like this felt like something you could see on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, or this felt like something like Charmed, like where it was just like, You almost like expected it to be like a TNT program after the basketball game. Like it was just like a, like some of the dialogue was real campy, and but at the end of the day, like it made for fun reading.
I think there's some inherent camp in superhero stories anyways, right? And when they become too self-serious, we get something like Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice, right? And I think it's probably fair to say that the 90s leaned into the camp in many camps, both, you know, at DC and Marvel, probably a little bit more than modern superhero comic books. And I think here it just really works. I think you have to... You have to embrace the camp to a certain extent when you're still talking about two universes represented by giant cosmic beings who don't get along, right? it's fascinating, right? As a basic premise for a major comic book. Like, don't expect, if there ever were to be a DC versus Marvel movie, if they ever, you know, would try to do something like that, don't expect this to be the premise, because it's, you know, they weren't willing to do Galactus, you know. He had to be a giant cloud in those old Fantastic Four movies. So, but there is inherent camp, I think, in superhero comics. And I think I'm grateful for that in the long run. Now, this book and 90s books in general were probably a little more campy than what we get today. But in a good way, I think. Like you said, it makes for good reading. There's a lot of entertainment value here.
I don't know. As a Thor reader, I think the campiness is ever present.
Yeah.
Dave, now you've teased this one a little bit and we've talked about it, but go full bone on your final like of this series.
I think it was really smart to make Doctor Strange Fate the antagonist of the story. And I don't really want to say the bad guy, because in a lot of ways his plan made perfect sense, right? He wanted to preserve his existence and the existence of his entire universe. This is something that, you know, Doctor Strange or Doctor Fate would have wanted to do too, you know, like if the shoe was on the other foot. So I shudder to call him the other bad guy. I don't think that's right. But he's certainly the antagonist of the story. And his goal to like re-merge the universes by causing these excursions and thereby restoring like all his friends and his entire universe, like that made perfect sense. And so I really liked that as the basic premise, and I really liked the end result too, because I think this is really where we get more amalgam stories from, is that they basically created like a pocket universe where all of these amalgamated characters get to exist in an existence that is just as real to them as the DC universe and the Marvel universe is to those heroes. And so I thought that was a great conclusion, right? To split them off and let these characters continue to exist without having to re-merge the DC and Marvel universes, and creating an opportunity for more amalgam stories if they so choose, which obviously they did. So I really liked the whole setup of the story. I really liked what the plan of Strange Fate was and how it ultimately concluded, because it was a very heroic thing, I think, for the Marvel and DC heroes to say, listen, this guy wants him and his universe just to exist. Let's try to find a way to make that happen without destroying our universes. That was definitely the heroic decision to make here. So I was pleased with that.
Yeah, I think it's really strong. And this is like, there are some themes there, or at least threads of them, that we've seen in sci-fi, and like I'm pretty sure I've seen a Star Trek episode where we have like like characters like that pop up. We have like the alternate Riker. I forget his name, but like
Thomas Riker.
Yeah. And then and so you kind of have like this crux and this debate of what the right thing to do is. Is it Tuvix from Voyager? Like that's a similar kind of.
Oh yeah, that's two beings merged together, and ultimately Janeway makes the controversial decision to split them back into two. Yeah, thereby erasing the new individual that was born. Yeah,
and that's still hotly debated 20 years later. So
it's still. I mean, if you go online and mention Tuvix, prepare for the storm.
Right. So yeah, I think that's a really kind of fascinating storyline, and not to mention the design is just impeccable. So like it looks cool, and in the era of the 90s, like that's you're 75% of the way there if you have a character design nailed. So yeah, I totally agree with you.
All right, so we've had our fun now with the things that we really liked about All Access. Let's go ahead and get a little nitpicky with this series. What have you got, Chris?
Yeah, so we've hinted at it before, but Axel is a forgettable bystander. it's such a kitschy like 90s name, like Axel, like, and he doesn't do a whole lot. He's got like this short buzz cut hair with like some American Gladiators type outfit on. Like it just seems really uninspired, and he's nothing more than an access point to the people that we really want to see. So yeah, he's completely forgettable.
I was really, that's the one thing I'm probably most disappointed about this series is simply that there is no real arc for him in the story. Like I thought the basic setup of him in DC versus Marvel was interesting, you know, and that issue where, you know, Strange Fate is hunting him, of the Amalgam comics, I thought that was really good too. Like, I thought there was at least a foundation there that they could have built off of. But even though this is called All Access, he is by far the least interesting character in that whole miniseries. Like, all the heroes, fantastic stuff, for the most part. There are some mischaracterizations, I'd say. But yeah, he just doesn't amount to much except for, like, you know, changing girlfriends by the end of the series. That's pretty much it.
Well, that leads us to your first dislike, because they tried to give him an arc, I guess, but nah.
Yeah, the girlfriend drama really didn't add anything to the story. Here, too, it just didn't amount to anything, right? Like, I guess what it's trying to tell us is somebody who can jump between two universes has a larger dating pool. Because first he's dating in the Marvel universe, but she can't, you know, she doesn't want to put up with his secretiveness. And so then he just goes ahead and jumps over to DC and starts dating somebody who he helped save in the first issue. Like, that is not an arc, right? And it doesn't really...
And there was no middling part to that, too. I had forgotten who that girl was. Like, I was like, who is this? Like, who's this person at the end?
Yeah, it's not really additive to the story, and it doesn't lend itself to the themes of the story or what's going on with the hero parts. The two parts just don't seem to mesh. And so I think you could have cut like the girlfriend drama parts out, and you would have gotten the exact same effect of this story, which is that Axel just doesn't amount to much here. All right, Chris, so what is your next dislike? And here, I think we're going to have the parting of the ways because of my own personal biases.
Yeah, I think we have a serious pro-DC bias. I know Mars was primarily writing for DC. I don't know that he wrote anything at Marvel during the 90s. I could be wrong. I haven't done a whole lot of research, but there's some serious pro-DC bias here. So you got Strange immediately getting jumped. Batman is this ineffable character that can do no wrong. Cyclops is wildly out of character. Jean is completely nerfed. The JLA is the grand savior, and they're the ones that come and jump the X-Men. And this is just a nitpick on my part. Spider-Man should have been there at the end. Like, he's probably the most identifiable character at Marvel, particularly in the 90s. And he's just this one-off character at the beginning. In issue one, but Superman's there at the end, so I was very disheartened by the third act of this, for the most part. So Yeah, there was some pro DC stuff going on. Yeah.
Well, I never liked that it devolved into hero versus hero to begin with. But, and it's hard to put yourself into the shoes of that time period unless you were there. But the JLA is the grand savior makes perfect sense when you realize that this is Morrison's JLA. Like, Morrison's JLA was the book in the 90s. There was nothing better or grander than Morrison's JLA among comic book fans. And anybody who got a chance to ride Morrison's JLA wrote Morrison's JLA like the greatest things in sliced bread. So I cannot, you know, I can't really complain about that. This is Morrison's JLA. And that really plays into the depiction of Batman as well. There's a reason that they started giving him the nickname Bat God around that time, you know, because Morrison's Batman was like the master planner, that, you know, the spider in the middle of the web that always has a contingency. That was how I think Morrison's writing compensated for the fact that Batman didn't have superpowers. He was always the smartest man in the room. I will say the Cyclops thing is totally accurate, even by my limited standards. He definitely out of character. And I think the thing with Jean would have been so much more interesting if she would have went head-to-head with Martian Manhunter more, since he is also a powerful telepath, and so seeing those two kind of squaring off in sort of a mindscape or something would have been really much more interesting than what they ended up doing with Jean. I think that was just a basic misunderstanding of how to pair them up better. And Spider-Man being there, I agree, would have been the smart move too. I think from a writing perspective, they might have been hesitant to have Spider-Man there because him and Supes have a good relationship. And as soon as you put Spider-Man in there, then maybe the hero versus hero thing is less likely to happen. I'm not sure. But yeah, I mean, I agree that there's a pro DC bias here. But, you know, since I'm have a pro DC bias, it kind of sings with me. So
yeah. So your second dislike we kind of covered, but is there more you want to put on that, Dave?
Yeah. I'm just gonna reiterate that I just really don't like constantly having to have hero versus hero. It's very rarely done in an interesting way. It always hinges on some kind of misunderstanding, and then by the end of the story, everybody's friends, right? And it's much more interesting when heroes meet, they recognize each other for what they are, right? And then they turn around and they try to solve the problem together. I have never been one of those people that even as a kid smashed action figures together, like imagining who would be stronger or something. To me, it was always more interesting to team people up. You should ask me sometimes about when I was 8 years old and teamed up Batman from Batman the Animated Series with Luke Skywalker. My action figures got a workout that day, and guess what? There was no fighting between the two heroes. So... All right, Chris, that brings us to your third and final dislike of All Access.
There is one moment, and I know that the kitschy, like, dorky, fun 90s sitcom vibe worked, but there's a moment where Axel and his girlfriend are taking a carriage ride through Central Park, and Jubilee shows up, who is underage, and the girlfriend insinuates that there is a relationship between assumingly adult Axel and teenage Jubilee, and it's just really uncomfortable, and it's yikes.
Yeah, I think, I forget now her name, but his Marvel girlfriend is really, really very poorly characterized here. She comes across as a real ding-dong, you know, like... Dude almost has a seizure and you know, at the beginning of the story, and he can just brush her off and leave, no problem. Then the carriage ride stuff, and then ultimately at the end, like, you live in the Marvel Universe and you see your boyfriend in a colorful costume, guess what's going on, right? instead she just runs off and is complaining that he's keeping secrets. I'm like, it doesn't take Sherlock Holmes to figure out what's going on here, lady. You live in the Marvel Universe, okay? So I think the characterization there is really poor to begin with.
Yeah, so Dave, your third and final dislike for All Access is...
The new amalgamations are really uninspired. Like, I had no interest in those new amalgamations they came up with. You know, the idea of merging, like, Justice League characters and X-Men characters is really interesting. But was it Bishop and Superman got merged or something? And suddenly Superman has a goatee? Like, that was, like, the grand amalgamation there? Like, I didn't really feel those amalgamations
at all. I think Martian Manhunter had a Jean Grey wig.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was just, I felt like those amalgamations were really uninspired. They very much felt like, you know, second, third choices that got rejected when they were making the original Amalgam universe, right? So I wish they would have done more interesting combinations between people when they had that opportunity just to play around with some, you know, one-off visual gags, basically. There would have been much more, like why not throw the you know, the two leaders of the time together, like Superman Cyclops would have been much more interesting, I think. I don't know, man. I just think that those were really uninspired.
I forgot it happened, honestly. So yeah, that's how forgettable they were.
Alrighty. So there you have it, folks. This was our review of All Access number 1-4. Get on social media and let us know how you felt about the miniseries that was the sequel to DC versus Marvel. You can find us anywhere, whether social media at Nerd by Word or individually at That Nerd Dave and at That Nerd Chris. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, it's going to be time for some nerd commendations. Alrighty, folks, and we're back, and it's time for our fan favorite segment. We call it Nerd Commendations. Alright, Chris, it's once again time to recommend some new nerdy media. What do you have for our listeners this week?
So, in the demise that is X-Men comics, and even at the time of recording, we've had the new stuff announced. I'm still have mixed emotions on that. So the thing that is really kind of keeping me afloat at Marvel Comics is this new Ultimate Universe. It's the thing that has me eagerly awaiting the next issue release. And one of those issues, one of those comics is Ultimate Black Panther. Now, I didn't read the first volume of Ultimate Black Panther originally, so this is completely new, uncharted territory to me. But I tell you what, between Blade, which I'm all the way caught up on now, and unfortunately is ending it at issue 10, but and Ultimate Black Panther, Brian Hill is just killing it, man. Everything that I have read by him recently, I've greatly enjoyed. And I know that I've nerd commended Blade before, but I'm gonna color outside the lines here and say you have to get caught up on that. Elena Casagrande's art on that is just spectacular. It's adventurous. It tells a story. The way she weaves through scenes is immaculate. But Ultimate Black Panther here is incredible as well. Stefano Caselli on art. Everybody looks gorgeous. Like, this is probably the most attractive cast in a comic book. Everybody looks incredible. You have a fascinating storyline where Moon Knight is the antagonist. It's this evil organization, part of this cabal that's been organized by the maker of Ra and Khonshu, being the sun and the moon, and together that they are Moon Knight, and they control the entire continent of Africa except for Wakanda. It's the last final holdout, this bastion of hope for the entire continent. And, you know, T'Challa is reluctant to go to war, but certain events take place where he finally relents, and there's spies involved. So there's like a 007 element to this where you don't know who's betraying him, but it's fascinating. The suit has grown on me. It looks like the Black Power Ranger, but that's okay because I love the Black Power Ranger. I absolutely love this series, and everything about the Ultimate Universe has me completely hooked. We don't even have Storm completely in this universe or in this yet. We've just had her teased a little bit, and we've got like some mystical prophecies involved. Like it's a real fun read.
Yeah, this sounds great. I've been generally pleased with what's going on with Ultimate Spider-Man. I've not given this one a chance yet. To be honest, it's been kind of difficult to find the time to read new comic books here lately. But it's definitely on my list because it looks like my kind of jam. And making that connection between Moon Knight and Black Panther in the way that you're describing, I think is a really interesting angle on those characters. And I'm really, really fascinated to actually sit down and read it, Chris.
All right. Now, we like to be consistent on this, and it wouldn't be a nerd commendation if it wasn't something weird from your department.
Yes, weird stuff time. Everybody buckle up. So, I was browsing around online the other day, and I came across a trailer for a game coming out on all platforms, Nintendo, Xbox, PlayStation, Steam, everywhere, called Euphoria: The Saga 2. And I think my jaw may have dropped a little bit, to be honest with you, because I remember the original, and I can't believe that we're getting a sequel this much later. I have not played the sequel yet, but it's on my list to purchase and play on my Steam Deck rather quickly. I really can't wait to give this one a shot. So in the meantime, before I actually play the new one and see if it holds up, I wanted to go ahead and nerd commend the original, if you can find it, because right now it's not really available anywhere, except for in my basement in my gaming room, because I have the original cartridge. Euphoria the Saga is actually from 1991. It's an action-adventure video game that was developed in Japan by Sunsoft for the Nintendo Entertainment System. And it is, for all intents and purposes, sort of an a mixture of a Metroidvania and sort of Mario jump-and-run game, right? So you play through a interconnected open world, right, where you are constantly finding new items that you're collecting that open up additional areas of the world. There's also four characters overall. You start with one character and you add other characters with other abilities that you can switch between at will, so you can get past certain obstacles and further explore the world. You know, with the abilities of these different characters as they join your party. And I remember playing this back in 91 when it came out and absolutely loving it. And I remember that the reception among my friend group and in general, really, for NES fans was sort of mixed to meddling. And then it was like released on Virtual Console back in the days of the Wii. And it kind of finally got some appreciation and had a bit of a cult following. And that is what ultimately, I think, inspired getting this sequel now. So the cool thing here is that we have now this sequel, which has this really cool painted look, like almost like a Yoshi's Crafted World sort of kind of look to it. It looks gorgeous, right? And it looks like it's preserving a lot of the gameplay elements that made the original so interesting to me back in 91. The sad thing is that the original is, as far as I know, currently not available on Nintendo Switch Online, and so there is no real way beyond emulation, beyond, you know, that, or finding the game in a secondhand store somewhere to actually experience this one. Which I think is a huge oversight. Like, this game needs to be on Nintendo Switch Online, like, stat, especially considering the sequel just came out. I think there's going to be some interest in the original then for a lot of people that encounter the sequel and find it interesting. But I just really remember this being the sort of Metroidvania game that actually worked for me. I struggled with the original Metroid games mightily. But this one just clicked, and I really liked the world and the gameplay, and the cutesy characters, very, you know, Japanese aesthetic in a lot of ways. I really liked this game, and so if there's a way for you to find this game, or if they eventually add it to Nintendo Switch Online, I highly recommend it, and I really can't wait to try the new one, and I will be coming back here and talking about it on the pod if it's worth nerd commending as soon as I play it. But if you get a chance, Euphoria the Saga for the original Nintendo Entertainment System, it really is one heck of a game, man.
Yeah, so like we talked about this earlier, but like the stranglehold that Nintendo has, it's really fascinating to see like the things that they do choose to put on Nintendo Switch Online. It seems to be like the only the games that they have 100% control over. So it's kind of disheartening a little bit that they don't add other stuff on there.
Yeah, I'm just excited really that I'm going to be able to buy a sequel to one of my favorite games from my childhood on my Steam Deck, and then just kick back and actually re-experience that world. I really hope the developers, you know, nailed this one. I'm very, very hopeful. This would be awesome. Alrighty, folks, there you have it. That was episode 183 of the Nerd Byword Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you just heard, please go on your favorite podcasting platform. Give us a rating and review and subscribe so you never miss another episode. You can find all of our episodes available on any podcasting platform, as well as our very own spiffy website, nerdbyword.com. And I also wanted to thank all our listeners for bearing with us the last couple of weeks, as we didn't have any episodes due to some technological glitches that we had to overcome. But I think we've worked out our recording system once again, and you should be expecting our episodes to drop weekly as they should.
And in the absence of that, if indeed we have not conquered that, but here's hoping, you can always find us on social media at Nerd by Word across all socials. And as always, stay well and stay nerdy.
The Nerd by Word is written and produced by Chris and Dave, two nerds with a love of all things pop culture. The podcast features music by Al Jimenez, with additional drops composed by Joe Biondi. Our show art is by Ashery Design. Find us at nerdbyword.com and wherever podcasts are available.